William was born in a state of poor and unfailing health. He was always a sickly child, but he had the comfort of a loving mother who sheltered him and served him. But then a dark and frowning providence entered William's life, and God took his mother in death. And William's life turned, a harsh turn, towards hardship. Now, William's father was not able to cope with a sick boy. For his whole life, William heard from his father that he was a burden to him and felt the pain of being unwanted by his father. Well, needless to say, he grew up suffering weak health. And as a young adult, he went to law school and did well. But as the time approached to take the bar exam, when you enter the profession, such was the intense pressure that on the eve of his exam, he attempted to hang himself. In William's day, when people tried to commit suicide, they were committed to an insane asylum where they were left for the rest of their lives, often only to become far, far worse. And so his life looks like a tragedy, doesn't it? He lost a mother, he had a harsh father, he was weak physically and suffered from tremendous mental health problems. And we might look at this and say, where on earth was God in the midst of this darkness? But the wonderful thing is, of course, is that God was orchestrating every event in William's life. So that in the darkest hour of his asylum, God came to him and Jesus Christ shined the light of the gospel into William's life, and he became a new man in Christ. And he was immediately well. He left the asylum and reflected upon those dark and frowning providences that had made him what he was. His full name was William Cooper, and we've just sung that hymn by him, that God moves in mysterious ways. Now, there is a man who could proclaim that heart and soul. And providence, of course, mysterious providences is the key theme, I think, through this chapter, indeed, as we've seen, haven't we already, throughout the book of Esther. God is always at work, but it seems to be an unseen hand. And providence is behind the reason why Esther finds herself in this royal court. Maybe because she had made some bad decisions. But providence means that Mordecai and her had just happened to be at the right place at the right time in order to foil a plot to destroy the Jews. Now, I know there's a number of people here tonight who've not been here for the others. Let me just remind you of some of the key elements of this story before we go on. We must remember that this is a drama. It's a play within a play. And it's a play about redemption of the peoples with Esther as the intercessor. But of course, there is a bigger picture here that we need to look at. There is a cosmic drama that's unfolding, and it begins at Genesis 3:15 and continues through the time of Esther and beyond. And here was an attempt to wipe out the messianic line, because it was from out of Jewry that, of course, Jesus Christ would come. So the idea being was, of course, you destroy the messianic line, there will be no Messiah. But this story talks about a great reversal. Peripety is what they call it. And it looks toward an even greater reversal to come. When Jesus Christ goes to the cross, it looks like he has lost. But actually, he's won a marvelous victory over sin and also death. And there's lots of devices and techniques. It's a political satire. There's humour. There is great irony, just to show the foolishness, as we saw this morning, of men such as Xerxes. The foolishness, as we shall see at another time, at the attempts by Haman to destroy the messianic line. And of course, as we read again in chapter 2, banquets play an important part, don't they, in the outworking of this story. So Esther, in one sense, is the female heroine of this, humanly speaking, But the real hero is the unseen hero, the unspoken hero in this, and that, of course, is God. And there are a lot of unexplained questions. I had listened once to a sermon by a Reformed preacher, and he entitled his sermon on this, Unexplained Questions. There's lots of questions we'd love to ask about this chapter, let alone what on earth's going on. There's lots of questions we'd like to ask, you know, about why and what motivations. We left a little bit unclear. What is going on? Why a beauty competition? What are Esther and Mordecai thinking about? Why are they entering such a competition? Why is Mordecai sitting at the king's gate? What's the king's gate? Why is he in that position of authority? What has this got to do with the Bible? More so, what's this got to do with God? And most importantly for me sitting here tonight, what's it got to do with me? Lots of questions, lots of things we can learn. And what we will see is God's providence at work, and even when we make bad decisions. You know, those bad decisions may be mistakes, as it were. Well, of course they are mistakes, but unintentional mistakes. Sometimes they're deliberate disobediences. But he uses those. He uses the wicked decisions of evil men, or maybe even the compromising decisions of his own people, to establish his purposes. And in this case, to foil the destruction of the Jewish people. And of course, the extermination of the Jews is a terrible thing. On an international level, it's a terrible thing. But in a way, this is not really the issue in the book. It's about the preservation of that messianic line. Okay, because it's from there that God will raise up a deliverer for all the nations, whom in due season will be exalted over every other name, and every knee shall bow, and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. So I commend this book to you, because it is about Jesus Christ. So we're being drawn into this story. These first two chapters really set the scene, but things really do rocket off in chapter 3. And I've got three things that I want to share with you tonight. And firstly, I want to have a look at, well, this won't surprise you, this heading, the mystery of God's providence. The mystery of God's providence. And then moving on from there, we want to have a look at the security in God's promises. The security in God's promises. And last of all, this is where it gets a little bit more challenging for us as Christians. And there's encouragement there too, if you shall see. Thirdly, I want to have a look at living in the light of God's providences. Okay? Living in the light of God's providences. So mystery, security, and living in the light of God's providences, or God's promises, however you want to phrase your headings. So, first of all, the mystery of God's providences. Now, by way of a prologue, let's have a look at where we are in the story. The times have actually moved on about 3 years or so. Okay, so 3 years have gone by. We can work that out because in verse 16 it talks about the seventh year of his reign, when Esther becomes queen. She's had about a year of beautifying. Okay, and then of course that means that, you know, there's another few years that has gone by. And much has happened since then, not just Sunday lunch for you all and afternoon activities, and you're here, okay, but actually a few years has gone under the bridge since then, and Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, depending on how you want to pronounce his name, has actually launched a huge war against the cities of Greece. It wasn't one country back then, it was lots of different city-states, and some of them actually fought for Xerxes and his father Darius in days gone by, and it ended up in a humiliating defeat to the king at two big battles. Salamis, big naval battle, and Plataea are two of the battles that are most notable, and another attempt would not be made. So we go back then to the court, and you can see after these things, in other words, after a period of time is what it means, when the anger of the king had abated, he remembered Vashti. There is no guitar here and no blues playing, but one wonders whether he's beginning to think, what have I done? I've decreed that she should be banished, and now I can't overturn a decree that's meant to be irrevocable. So what am I going to do, you see? And so he's beginning then perhaps to think of the need for a new queen. So there's lots of regrets that are there. He seems to be trapped by his own decision. Maybe he's uneasy with that decision. He's sorry. He wants to have her back as well. And of course, if the king is unhappy, most importantly, everyone else is too. And that's the reason why they come up with this idea by saying, let these beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces to gather all the young virgins into the harem. Okay, and it says in verse 4, and this is important, this pleased the king, you see. One commentator says that when it says the king was pleased, that's the oil of Persian bureaucracy. If he was pleased, things moved quickly. So there is this then beauty competition. I mean, can you believe it? We're actually reading about a beauty competition here in the Bible. And of course, they were known to have numerous concubines along with their wives. Xerxes' son, Artaxerxes, was said to have 360 of these concubines of surpassing beauty. And they were regularly replenished by gathering virgins from the land. So these young girls were brought, maybe even herded, into the harem of Xerxes' court. And we don't know how many there might well have been. There could have been as many as 400 or even 1,400. Okay, and they were taken. That may or may not mean that they were coerced. It's difficult to know whether these girls were drafted, like you're drafted into the army, whether they were forced or whether they chose to go. These are one of the unexplained questions. We just don't know whether that's the case. Of course, it wasn't just young women that were drafted, as it were, or brought into the court. So were young boys. The Greek historian Herodotus reports that 500 boys were castrated every year in the Persian court. I'm not too sure which, if any, had the best deal. In fact, actually, somebody said to me today, none of them had the best deal, because that is power. You know, everything is beheld to the power. You summon a queen, you issue edicts, you go to war, you castrate young boys, you bring in young virgins. All of that is an expression of power, that everyone, male or female, was at the disposal, at the whim of king. And it's interesting, you know, that Esther, as we shall meet in a moment, is carried in to the court. That's the same word they talk about being carried into Babylonian exile. So she is unfortunate, perhaps, well, it's providential for us, of course, but for her, she might feel it's unfortunate. She's got a double exile here. Her people have been exiled, and now she's exiled in court, you see here. Okay, so Esther is introduced. You have to remember, this is not some Miss Universe. It's a terrible competition anyway. But this is not Miss Universe. It's certainly not Cinderella's ball. Okay, it's not about being the lucky girl, as it were. You know, they were uprooted from the towns and the cities. It probably deprived a lot of the men, young men, of potential wives. And those who did not make the cut were shut up in perpetual widowhood as concubines, because once they had lost their virginity to the king's whim, they were not marriageable material after that. And then, of course, you have the 12 months preparation of perfume, and boy, did they know how to paint the barn, didn't they, in that respect, of spices and so on and so forth. So we're introduced there to Esther in verse 15. She enters this competition. We don't know whether she was forced to, whether she chose to go to do so, or whatever. Those are unanswered questions. Some, no doubt, when they went reveled in this. Others, it was the most horrific thing. So we don't know, of course, whether they were coerced. But in comes Esther into our story, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who is effectively her guardian. She is very beautiful, strikingly beautiful. and said by the rabbis to be one of the four most beautiful women in the Old Testament, along with Sarah, Rahab, and Abigail. So in describing this beauty there, the author is aligning her with the other beautiful woman that we met this morning, which is Vashti. Okay. Now we will consider perhaps the motivations or the choices that they would have made, Esther and Mordecai, made in one moment. But all of this competition is about God, really, working in his purposes, as we shall see in a moment, in the most mundane and ordinary way. Okay. Or should I rephrase that? In an extraordinary way, but through mundane and ordinary events. Maybe that's the best way to put it. In this case, beauty competitions. There is, later on in the passage, right at the very end, and we will jump to that now before having a look at applying this in one moment, another example of God's providence. It seems to be, doesn't it, attached right at the very end, where it talks there about Mordecai discovering a plot by two eunuchs to assassinate Xerxes. Now, guarding that threshold, the king's doorway, was only allowed by his most trusted guards. But it was a hazard of the job that the king could be murdered by those so-called trusted associates, be they eunuchs, palace guards, or nobles of his councils. And there's been many examples down through history of bodyguards being paid or choosing to murder the rulers of their country to further their own ends. Roman Caesars have been murdered by their own nobles and by their so-called Praetorian Guard. Ottoman caliphs in Turkey were overrun by their feared Janissaries, which were converts to Islam, that were the feared troops of the Ottoman Empire. So Mordecai is sitting at the gate. Now, sitting at the gate sounds like a leisurely activity, doesn't it? But it's not at all. It's actually a position of authority. He's dispensing the king's justice. So the gate is not some kind of back garden gate. And if the archaeological evidence of Susa is correct, this gate was huge. It was several hundred foot, you know, wide and tall, and was built by Darius, who was Xerxes' father. There's inscriptions on the base of all the columns saying, Xerxes the king says, by the grace of Ahuramazda, the gate, Darius the king made it, he who was my father. Okay, and so why Mordecai is sitting at the gate, why Mordecai has that authority and now comes across the plot, in a sense, we don't know. Maybe he was being put there because now Esther was queen, he enjoyed her patronage. But we don't know, do we? But the fact is, what we do know, it's in God's providence, as we shall see later on, because he is rewarded for it by being recorded in the book of the Chronicles of the present king. That was like being mentioned in dispatches if you're in the army. Okay, if you're in the army, get mentioned, dispatches, one of the most senior awards that you can get. You get an oak leaf cluster or something that you can wear as well. The idea being is that you'll be rewarded and be remembered and be promoted. But actually, as we shall see later on, the king forgot all about Mordecai until one sleepless night. See, God is working his providences. So we see the mysteries of his providences in so many ways, and yet there's so many answers that we, so many questions that we can't answer. But what the author is doing is it's like putting another element of a piece of a jigsaw into the puzzle that it helps us to understand why Mordecai and Esther are in the right place at the right time, and why at the end of it we should not be sitting down and saying, now that was lucky, it is God's providences. And this is the way that God acts, as we shall see. So this providence then, you know, what exactly is it? Well, I'm not going to go into a big theological lecture about it, but providence is God sustaining and maintaining history by his hand. Okay? And a bunch of German Christians got together in the 1560s, and they asked the question, Now, what do you mean by the providence of God? And they said this, that it is the almighty and ever-present power of God by which God upholds, as with his hand, heaven and earth and all creatures, and so rules them. That, and I like this, it's a nice rhythm to it, that leaf and blade, rain and drought, fruitful and lean years, food and drink, health and sickness, prosperity and poverty, all things in fact, come to us not by chance, but by his fatherly hand. And then they ask a question, you know, what we would say, well, what does that mean to me? But they say this, how does the knowledge of God's creation and providence help us? What does it mean to us? And they say this, we can be patient when things go against us, thankful when things go well, and for the future we can have good confidence in our faithful God and Father, that nothing in creation will separate us from his love, for all creatures are so completely in God's hand, that without his will they can neither move nor be moved. You see? And we would say amen to that, but sometimes in our lives you've got to wonder whether we live by those things, as we shall see later on. And it's not just a catechism like that. That's from the Heidelberg Catechism of 1563, I think it was. But there is verses that point towards God's hand in events throughout the Bible. Again, not too many of those, I will say tonight, but I've got one or two here. Daniel 2:21, he changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. That's the reason why I picked that one, you see. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. And Daniel would know what it was like to live in the light of God's providence, you see, if you know the story. And there is a purpose, you see, to God's redemption. That purpose is redemptive. And God is using the wicked, using our bad decisions for good purposes. Sometimes to protect and to shield his people, and other times to purify them, to refine his people. You know, just look at what the Babylonian exile was to the Jewish people. It was a disaster, wasn't it? And yet we know that there was a bigger purpose here at hand. And that's the important thing, you see. The purpose of Esther is to, on one hand, is to explain the origins of Purim, which of course is a huge feast. But really, it testifies to God's resolve, does it not? It testifies to God's resolve that, his relentless resolve, that he will fulfill his purposes and raise up a deliverer that will crush Satan's head. You know, I think sometimes, whether we're Christians or not, you know, certainly as Christians, we think that, you know, if we had the government of the world in our hands, we would do a lot better. We might not say that, but sometimes we almost joke, if I was dictator, I'd do this. You certainly get that among teachers amongst us. So I'd do it differently if it was me. But, you know, if you're anything like me, you can't get the same pair of socks that match out of the washing machine, or you're involved in what seems to be a life and death struggle with a duvet cover, you know, it's a good job, isn't it, that we don't have to run the whole world. That's what God can do. Now, I don't want to be flippant about God's providences, but the important thing is that we can make all these wrong decisions. And actually, you know, we might choose the wrong decisions for some of the biblical characters. You know, we would look at, say, the book of Ruth, which is an interesting companion piece to Esther. The only one really where the female, again, is the hero, humanly speaking, of the book. And do you want Naomi to lose her husband and children? Of course not. But God knows what he's doing, because then they come back to Israel. And from, you know, Ruth, of course, we have the line of David, and from that, the messianic line. If it was down to me, well, we'd be stuffed, wouldn't we, really? Yes, we would be. So we would make all these wrong decisions. You know, we wouldn't know what's going to happen, but God knows what he is doing. Of course, being a purposeful providence, it's redemptive. And of course, in that, of course, Jesus is the fulfillment, as we've been saying. He is the intercessor, par exemplar, to whom Esther, in some respects, looks toward. He is the king that all the kings of the Bible look towards. You know, he's a priest that all the priests look towards. He is a prophet that all the prophets look towards. So we need to interpret the cosmos. We need to interpret this drama that's unfolding in our own personal world in the light of the purposeful sovereignty of God. You know, and what's interesting, just to finish off with, is that, you know, they might be redemptive and purposeful, but so often they're through the ordinary. Okay? The ordinary, just a beauty competition. And yet that's going to be crucial to the story. Well, if you step outside the book once again, look at his ordinary providences in somewhere like Ruth, for example. She turns up at the harvest, and the words that the author used there is, happened to come, as it turned out. Or literally in the Hebrew, the words are, and her chance chanced. Okay? And of course, the writer, like the writer in Esther, is using this hyperbole. He's not saying it's lucky. She didn't plan it. She didn't know of Boaz. I'm talking here of Ruth. And you may not know the story. But it's not about chance, really. Ironically, it's the opposite. It's down to the providential sovereignty of God. You see? And it's just a harvest. It's just so ordinary. And yet it's used for to help accomplish God's purposes. Because that's where she meets Boaz. They have a child. From that line, like I said, it's David. And ultimately, Jesus, the Messiah. And we're in the midst of these redemptive purposes. I wonder, you know, whether you get up sometimes and wonder what God is going to do. Because we're caught up, really, in the midst of these redemptive purposes. You may feel that nothing of any great moments impinge on your life, that life is boring. But there is nothing mundane about our existence. We are caught up in Jesus Christ for his cosmic purposes. It may not appear like that, but it is always like that. And it is always like that every time. Christian, you know, God is about the business of pursuing to perfection his purposes for this world, even in the most ordinary circumstances and situations. He doesn't always need a fanfare, does he? He doesn't always need a trumpeter. He expects us to see with the eye of faith, to see that all things work together for the good of those who love God or love him, as it says up behind me that is there. And that should be a comfort to you, Christian. That should be a comfort to you, Christian, and uplifting to know that you're not just some kind of small cog in a machine, that he's caught us up by his son in the midst of this drama. And it should guard against us to think that for one moment that my life is dull. And you see, we look through the glass darkly at the moment. There's a kind of a shadow, an adumbrated outline, a little glimpse here and there. But sometimes we see nothing, as I said already, this side of glory. And it's a comfort to us if you're walking in darkness. I don't know whether that's you here tonight, Christian or not a Christian. Are you walking in darkness? I mean, God is pleased that I've not known what it's like to walk in almost complete darkness. But some of you have known that. It's when it's felt like there's not even been a pinprick of light by which to see your way. But Isaiah 50 tells us, let him who walks in darkness and has no light trust in the name of the Lord. If you know the sovereignty of God, if you can declare and proclaim the sovereignty of God, you can trust and rely on the God of the Bible, your covenant God. God says to his people that those who walk in the dark, those who can't see beyond themselves, that there is a rhythm, that there is a rhyme to my purposes and to my meaning, he says. There's a significance in this life. There, you know, trust in God, trust in his wisdom, trust in his goodness, trust in his mercy, in his kindness. Trust in the sovereignty of God, because you belong to the one who has caught you up in that divine drama of redemption. What about you, friend? What about you? Have you put your trust in the Lord Jesus Christ? You know, these verses that we have been looking at tells us that the living God is pursuing in a resolved and relentless way, determined to pursue those purposes that will see the exaltation of his Son. His resolve, of course, is to bring that Redeemer out of the womb of Jewry, the Lord Jesus Christ. And our That text, I've mentioned it a couple of times already, Genesis 3:15, is that lens text. It's like your pair of glasses by which you should view the whole of the Bible. From the seed of the woman, it'll crush your head. And that's why we should have comfort, that our help comes in the name of the Lord who makes the heavens and the earth. He will exalt his son. We can bank on this. We can depend on it. We know that every knee will bow, every tongue confess. If it's from the overflowering flowing of a heart of thanksgiving, or whether you are constrained by his sovereign power ere you're cast into the lake of fire, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is a Lord. He is truly a God who appears to hide himself in these mysterious providences. But what daring, what majesty, what glory for those eyes who are those who have eyes to see. The mystery of God's providences. And slightly shorter then for this second point, we have the security of God's providences or his promises, however you want to phrase it. Now, here, of course, the security that we get comes out of what I've already been saying, isn't it, really? If you believe in God's providence, if you have comfort in that, then you can have security in it. I realise that that makes perfect and logical sense. But it's actually also here in the text too. And here, let's have a look at Mordecai. Okay, Mordecai here is described in verse 5. A Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name is Mordecai. And then it goes through his whole lineage. It says, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, if Mordecai had been carried away by Nebuchadnezzar, he and also Esther would be very old indeed. But what it means by it, telescopes the whole of the generations. In a sense, what it's saying is Mordecai was carried away in the loins of Jeconiah. In other words, it connects Mordecai with the covenant people of God before the exile. And that's the important point that is there. And there's two reasons for why it connects with the people of God. Firstly, and perhaps most importantly, it prepares the ground for the reason for the enmity between Mordecai and Haman that we shall see in the following chapter. Okay, but we've not got there yet. And I'll tell you now, the name of Kish is very important indeed, because it says that he will be a descendant of Saul. And we shall see that Haman is an Agagite. So there is a history that is there, and I'll explain that more fully another time. But there is a purpose, second purpose that is here, and that's what I just want to focus on for today. That deliberate reference, as I said, links Mordecai to the rest of God's covenant people who were sent into exile. That God has purposed and planned for this exile, that all those years before the very foundations of the earth, the Babylonian exile had been planned, hadn't it? And it just happened to be that Mordecai's family were among those who were exiles. And wasn't it lucky that he just happened to be born at a time and raised to a point of position where he could help to save the Jewish people? What a coincidence. But it's not, is it? It is part of God's promises. And what it reminds us is that even before the very foundation of the earth, God has got a plan to deliver his covenant people. And in that we have security, do we not? The deliverance of his people. You see, what it shows us in those few verses of Mordecai is, you know, here the Jewish nation, against all odds, will be delivered from their enemies who would destroy them. Okay? And the enemies are not one nation. They are not really Haman either, as we shall see later. But the story is about the hostility of the world against God's people. Okay? And it's about that reversal when God's enemies will be defeated. His people will be delivered. Because he is a God who is ever faithful. As we've seen, there's this war going on. We are the players in the play this very age, are we not? So were Esther and Mordecai. Those were the troops on the ground at that particular time. and Esther would be used as a magnificently, marvellously, as an agent of God's providence. And the church has inherited those same promises of deliverance that the Israelites had been. And the apostles knew this in the book of Acts when they have been imprisoned and released in Acts 4. If you remember, they intervene with a lame man, they end up in prison. The authorities are struck by the boldness of what they are doing. They are released, they go back to their friends, and they report what's happened, and they lift their voice together, and they quote from that companion piece of Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage against God? And what they're doing is they're getting perspective on what had happened. Okay? They've been sent out by the risen Jesus to the ends of the earth. I mean, they've hardly got a foot or two along the way, and they're already in the nick, you see. And they've reminded themselves, you are a sovereign God. You are the creator of the ends of the earth and the sea. Are we surprised that this has happened? No, because there is a war that is going on. You see, that is the security we have in God's promises, that we may be fighting this battle, fighting this war, but God is there to protect us. Psalm 54 says this, come with great power, O Lord. Rescue me, defend me with your might. Listen to my prayer, O God. Be attentive to my plea, for strangers are attacking me. Violent people are trying to kill me. See, that's what the apostles could say. That's what the Jews could say here. And that's what our brothers and sisters can say down through gospel history, can they not? Even today they may be able to say that. The Lord keeps me alive, says the psalmist. May the evil plans of my enemies be turned against them. Do as you promise and put an end to them. And that's what happens here with Haman. That's what happens with all the nations that rage against God. God's enemies will be defeated, and he will put an end to them. Okay? So it's part of that great conflict that's unfolding. But we have the security that in this war, as his soldiers, as it were, as his people, because we are his covenant people, just like Mordecai was part of the covenant people there in those verses 5, 6 and 7. You know, those covenant people may not be an ethnic group or lineage, but we're still his covenant people, are we not? We praise our covenant God and his faithfulness. And even though the world rails against us, God will always deliver his people against his enemies. In that sense, this story here, friends, is part of our own Christian heritage. We're part of that great chain in redemptive history. All those who refuse to kiss the Son, to allude to Psalm 2, will be destroyed, or they will spend eternity in the lake of fire. So that is security in God's providences. So much more, I'd love to say about that. But thirdly, and finally, and this is where we got a challenge, this is where we got some comfort too, and some encouragement, living in the light of God's providence. There is a deliverance here, but there is also a challenge, and there is also comfort, because Esther and Mordecai are faced with this issue of relating their faith to the Persian culture. Okay, I mean, before the exile, they're in their own country, they had their own king, they could worship freely, they might have certain freedoms in exile, but they were ruled by pagan kings, Gentiles. If it wasn't the Persians, it would be Greece later, then it would be Rome. And we've got to ask ourselves, I suppose, if you've not done already, what on earth are Mordecai and Esther thinking? Why are they involved in this competition? Why is Mordecai where he is? Why does Mordecai tell Esther, keep the fact that you're a Jew secret? There's lots of questions that are here. In fact, Esther is the only character in this book who's given two names, Esther and Hadassah. Esther, it may well be the pagan name that she's been given, Ishtar, the Babylonian goddess of love and war, which is quite apt if it really is intended to be that deliberate, because she has a king fall in love with her, but she wages war against the enemies of God, as we shall see later on. And Mordecai, well, that name may be a corruption of Marduk, who's a Babylonian god. We do know of a Marduk who was quite a senior, I suppose, an accountant within the Persian hierarchy. There's no way of telling if he is the same person as we got in front of us. But Esther's the only one who's given these two names. And Hadassah means myrtle. But if it's transliterated into Persian, I think it means something to the words of the God hides, which is quite convenient, isn't it? Because that's what's happened here. God is, it were, seemingly hiding. His work is unseen. It's behind the scenes. But maybe it's the fact that being two names, that she's living in two worlds, a Jewish world and a Persian world. And maybe, you know, this is what Mordecai and Esther are doing. Maybe they have been assimilated. Maybe they are compromising their faith. And you can see it from that perspective. He asks her to conceal our identity. Again, why does he do this? Well, the author doesn't tell us why. We have no idea of his motivation. Okay? Because later on, he reveals who he is when he refuses to bow to Haman. Perhaps Mordecai knows that anti-Semitism is lurking round the corner. Whether he probably didn't, I don't think he knew that the plot that was about to unfold would result in the massacre of the Jewish people. We just don't know. So he is certainly, you know, getting her to conceal her identity. And she does the same thing. She adopts the Persian dress and the customs. She might become almost indistinguishable. But obviously the Jews were a distinguishable group. Otherwise, you know, he wouldn't be labelled the Jew. You know, that word Jew that you see there, you could read right past that. But I read somewhere and I looked it up that actually it's very much a post-exilic word. Because they've been in exile and now they're back again. So the word Jew is only used a few times in other books, but over 40 times in the book of Esther. Why is that? Because, of course, it's the Jewish people that are under great threat from the destruction by Haman and his supporters. So they conceal their identity. They can compromise their faith. You could argue they compromise on the law. You know, she sleeps with a pagan Gentile. She eats their food. Okay, so there's a compromise in the law and also morality. But it's very easy, isn't it, to be overly critical of these two people. We don't know to what extent they really were compromising. Perhaps by law, perhaps in their faith. Again, if she is conscripted into this beauty competition, we don't know that, then what choice does she have? And she's a woman, and a woman in a man's world, and that means her actions and our responses may well be different from that of Daniel. We might despair at Mordecai. We may be critical of him and Esther. You know, but you know, the author does not vindicate their actions. He doesn't defend them. He doesn't attack them. You know, he just explains exactly what happened. So what can we learn from these things, from these unanswered, as it were, questions? So there are no simple answers, by the way, are there, to this? After all, we're not in that situation, but we are challenged as well, aren't we, to live a life of faithfulness in our culture. And we are just as much under threat of being assimilated by the world as Esther and Mordecai. The world that we live in is totalitarian in many ways. It likes to control the totality of life, especially now with the role of technology. We may not face the threats, but sometimes we are shamed, aren't we, if we do not wish to be part of the culture that we belong to. But we have a challenge anyway, living a life of faithfulness in that culture, and that's a hard one. Does that mean then if we dress like everybody else that we are assimilated? Well, perhaps not. If we choose to keep our faith secret, are we unfaithful or are we simply prudent? Who knows? I think if we were to have a discussion about this afterwards, we'd all have a different line, wouldn't we, in which we would draw and where we would go with those things. But we have this challenge that is there. You know, there's a wonderful film, a musical, that is called Fiddler on the Roof. Okay? And the main character that is there says, "Life is like a fiddler on the roof." It sounds crazy, though. But here in our little village of Anatevka, You might say every one of us is a fiddler on the roof, trying to scratch out a pleasant, simple tune without breaking his neck. It isn't easy. You may ask, why do you stay up there if it's so dangerous? Well, we stay because Anatevka is our home. And how do we keep our balance? That I can tell you in one word, tradition, he goes. Now, you see, you know, these Jews lived in the Russian Empire at a time where they faced the possibility of pogroms. They are ethnic cleansings by the Russian government in the 1880s and the 1890s. Huge massacres. And eventually they have to leave their village. Okay? And we face, well, maybe not the threat of pogroms and massacres, but we face the possibility of assimilation. But it's not a roof in which we can fiddle. It is a rock. The rock is Jesus Christ. That is upon whom we rest. It's very easy to reverse a Japanese proverb that a nail that doesn't stick out is much less likely to be hammered. It's very easy to want to remain camouflage, isn't it? But the challenge is to preserve our distinctiveness as his people. But we will always disagree, perhaps, between us where that line might well be. We might well disagree that the decisions that Esther have made, wise or imprudent, but we need to strive to live in obedience with the Lord. And that isn't always clear sometimes in the sin-cursed, fallen world that we live in, because we live in that tension. Just look at the decisions that Christian pastors had to make in the 1930s with Hitler. Some thought it was the best way forward to agree with what, you know, with Hitler and the regime, and then realized their wrong mistake later. Others, the confessing church, chose to resist from the very beginning. If you look at somebody like Bonhoeffer, for example, he ended up being caught in a conspiracy to assassinate Hitler. Is that right? Well, he ended up dying for his faith, hung probably on the end of a giant meat hook. But there is not only a challenge, and this is really where I do need to finish, and there is also a powerful encouragement that is here, because their lives and the way they live them are a powerful encouragement. You know, it might well be that they've compromised. You may take a really negative view. I don't personally, by the way, a really negative view of their compromises. But it's a powerful encouragement, you know, that these characters are flesh and blood like us, you see. And here I talk to as a real person, to real people. And let's just be honest with ourselves. Which one of us has ever lived in such a way that we have never compromised our biblical integrity? Okay? I mean, they may have been those innocent blunders or deliberate disobediences, but not one of us here, I challenge you here today, not one of us is exempt from the situation that faced something like Esther and Mordecai. Okay, we've been in those situations ourselves, and the compromising decisions that these two make resonate us. We may be very disappointed. We're yet to get to the point where they prove themselves to be human heroes. Okay, but we can have comfort that the invisible hand of God is so powerful, so solid, that even our bad decisions end up as being part of his divine appointments. Okay. The evil decisions of wicked men, the sinful decisions of his people still fit in with his divine purposes. Now, that's not an approbation, by the way, friends. I ain't here to stand here tonight in front of you to say, well, it's a comfort before we make those wrong decisions, but we might do so, have that comfort after we've made those decisions. It reminds us that God is king over all, that he is establishing his purposes in our lives. And there are people here in the congregation today, myself included, who have made foolish choices. Again, I don't think any of us can stand up and put our hand up and say, I've not made a foolish choice in my Christian life. And I will call into question your integrity if you were to do that. Okay. Some of us have been involved in bad relationships. Some of us have made sinful decisions. We've compromised biblical integrity for convenience. Have I got everybody here? Okay, well, what do we do then? Do we live a life of regret? And what if only if I'd done that differently, if I'd only done it another way? I mean, obviously, in a sense, we should regret because our sin will ever be there before. So some of us, we're faced with that sin every day of our lives after because of the consequences of our actions. But we should not be in a state of despair. No, we should not be in a state of despair because we've not thwarted the purposes of God. At the end of the day, he is big enough, he is sovereign enough to say, you know, that despite of us, despite of our bad decisions, Simon Daniel, despite of your poor choices, I have established my purposes. I have accomplished my will. Look at that verse up there. In all things, God works for the good of those who love him. I don't like amending Bible verses. Don't think it's right. But maybe you might put in brackets, even in the most stupid things that you do, Simon. And that should be the same for the rest of you. He works for the good of us. We serve a God in whom there is no what ifs. There are no what ifs. And in that, friends, we can take comfort. He will work. He will work mightily through Esther and Mordecai, saving his people, establishing his purposes, preserving the messianic line, even though they don't live lives like they should, even though, you know, his kingdom advances, even though we don't live our lives as we should. And we should look to the scripture for our help. You look at the judges, you look at the Gideons and the Japhets, you look at the Samsons, the so-called Hall of Martyrs, they're just as flawed as we are. You see, and we can take comfort because all those bad decisions, all those compromises, in a sense, they're like camouflage for God to do great things despite us. Now, we are called to trust in him, walk by faith, not by sight, and no amount of sin or guilt should hinder us from laying hold of God in Christ. And that is the best news. There was once a Puritan called Samuel Rutherford, Scotsman, used to write letters to his congregation, quite a lot of aristocrats that were there. And there was Lady Kenmure, she suffered from bouts of depression, and he wrote this letter. It's very touching. "Madam, when you are come to the other side of the water and have set your foot down on the shore of glorious eternity, and look back again to the waters and to your wearisome journey, and shall see in that clear glass of endless glory, near to the bottom of God's wisdom, ye shall then be forced to say, if God had done otherwise with you than he hath done, I had never come to the enjoying of this crown of glory. At the end of the day, he will be glorified and he will overrule, friends, terrible events, wicked men, our compromises, our bad decisions, our sinful directions, because the Lord is king and we are secure in the Lord. To him be the glory. Amen. Amen.